Welcome to Shattering This, a program devoted to the fastest growing segment of society, to those who know that the world's political, religious, military, and economic institutions are corrupt, that they are counterproductive, that they cannot be fixed. Our mission, therefore, is to look behind the scenes to know who is working against our interests, to understand why they're doing so. Because ultimately exposing and condemning errant and treacherous schemes, even if they are political, even if they're patriotic, it isn't hateful. It's caring. In our concluding hour, we're going to use evidence and reason to explore the Torah, which means demeaning religion. The Torah means teaching, and its liberating and empowering covenant provides the only reliable answer for you and your family. Our phone number, anytime over the next 3 hours, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, is 877-300-7645. The lead item in the news was data was deleted from the pilot's flight simulator. Meaningless. The fact that the pilot had a flight simulator, kind of the Microsoft variety with several screens, though, so it was a nice flight simulator in his home to practice flying. Is probably a positive thing. The fact that he deleted data is immaterial. The reality is we have no idea why that plane went off course. When I first heard the story, it immediately sounded to me like that there was a rapid decompression of the cabin, and that at the time they would have been flying probably at around 35,000 feet in a rapid decompression. You know, the pilots have about 30 seconds at that point to don their oxygen mask. If they do so, then they recover and continue to fly. But if that rapid decompression took place in such a way that they were distracted, if they had not practiced donning their oxygen mask, if the decompression was slightly more gradual, for example, they may have all blacked out. And almost everything that happened thereafter could be attributed to the airplane just continuing to wallow through the sky. It's gain in altitude, it's loss of altitude, and the like. The only question then becomes, why were portions of the data reporting systems disabled? Chances are, at least based upon what little we know, this aircraft is likely lost and will never be found. The one of the ads that played during the introduction to the program claimed that God led someone to a cancer care center. I just want the advertiser might be advertising for a very fine product. The cancer care centers may do a marvelous job of treating cancer, but when you run an ad that claims that God sent someone to your center, that's really very perverted. That's like saying that God gave you cancer so that he could direct your path, and that he is this micromanager that wanted to make sure that you went to this place versus a hospital someplace else. You know, God intervening in that way, but not intervening to prevent your cancer, makes God not only a micromanager, but also perverted. We just really ought not be making those kind of claims. CNN reported a story about a week ago about a high school student that was suing her parents for tuition, for her car allowance, for living allowance, and this sort of thing. And the parents claimed that, you know, the girl was violating the house rules, and that she could free to do so if she just couldn't live in the house while abusing the house rules. I don't know a lot about this case. I'm going to share a little bit with you this morning as an update. But there really have to be house rules. If there aren't house rules, if there aren't expectations of proper behavior, a home disintegrates and the home becomes no better than the hellish conditions that are so prevalent in our world today. The reason I share this, of course, is that in the covenant, Yahweh says that heaven is his home, and that if you want to enter his home, then there are certain conditions that he expects. And if they're accepted, you're welcomed in. If they're rejected, you're not. The first of those requirements is that you walk away from religion and politics. That's why we begin this show every day by exposing much of the malfeasance occurring around the world as a result of religion and patriotism, militarism, or economic schemes. God recognizes that if he allowed religion and politics, patriotism, militarism, these kinds of things in his home, then life in heaven would be as hellish as it is here on earth. The difference would be that it would be eternally hellish. And so these parents deciding that their daughter was free to ignore their rules if she wished to, but wasn't free to live in their home while rejecting the house rules, seems highly appropriate to me. Now, here's the update on the story. The high school senior who sued her mother and father for financial support and college tuition dropped her lawsuit today, according to a decision by a superior court judge in Morristown, New Jersey. Rachel Canning, 18, who returned home and is reunited with her parents in Lincoln Park, appeared in court and testified that she decided to dismiss her complaint. This is a very troubled young lady, by the way. Canning alleged in her lawsuit that her parents had forced her out of their home and that she was unable to support herself financially. She's 18 years old. If her parents choose to force her out of their home, they can do so. And they're not entitled, they're not required to pay a 18-year-old's upkeep. Now, the fact is, they just told her to leave their home because her behavior was inappropriate. Her lawsuit asked that her parents make the remaining tuition payments for her private high school, which happens to be a Catholic high school. Might speak to why the girl is so messed up. Doesn't speak well of her parents, certainly, by sending her to a Catholic high school. That they pay her current living expenses, which were her trying to live with her boyfriend, and her transportation expenses, which means to give her a car, and to commit to paying her college tuition, as well as to reimburse her friend's parents, this would be her boyfriend's parents, for the legal fees of her bringing her case against her parents. Now, the parents said that Rachel left home because she didn't want to follow their house rules. Canning, an honor student, which doesn't mean much in today's world, and a cheerleader at Morris Catholic High School, said that in court documents that she had to leave her parents' home because of emotional and psychological mistreatment. Oh, boy. She alleged, among other things, that her mother called her fat and porky. I think those things would be related, so we just say her mother called her porky. And her father threatened to beat her. Now, my guess is that her father didn't threaten to beat her, and her mother might have said, hey, looking a little porky there. Canning was suspended from school. Now, here's the real story. In October, for truancy, according to court documents filed by her parents' former attorney, Lori Rush Masur, her parents told the teen that she could no longer see her boyfriend, who was also suspended from the school for truancy. The car and phone privileges were taken away. So here they're paying the tuition for this girl to go to a private school, and she instead spends her time with her truant boyfriend. Now, my son, my daughter, and they were doing that, abusing our willingness to pay for a private education. They're done in that regard. I wouldn't tell them for that reason alone they'd have to move out of the house. But we made it quite clear to our sons when they chose to go to private school rather than public school. And we tried public school. It just was a horrific experience in terms of the quality of education, non-existent in the public school. Just, it was pathetic. We interviewed the teachers and just shook our head and said, oh, my God, how in the world are our tax dollars compelling us to pay for this absolute worthlessness? And so they wanted to go to private school. We agreed we would pay for private school, but there was a contract with them. You know, not a written contract, an oral contract. It says, we'll do this, but you apply yourself. You know, you do your homework, you pay attention in class, you give it your best effort, you participate in the school activities. We'll do this so long as you take advantage of it. If you don't, if you squander the opportunity, then we won't. You know, that's reasonable. Well, this girl chose to spend her days out of class with her truant boyfriend. Now, once the girl learned of the punishment, which were her car and phone privileges were taken away, she cut school again and decided to run away. And under these circumstances, she sued her parents? Astounding. After receiving the allegations that Rachel was being abused, being called Porky, and the threat to of a beating, the New Jersey Division of Child Protective Services interviewed the teen, interviewed her parents, interviewed her two younger sisters, and determined that the allegations of emotional and physical abuse were completely unfounded. This is a case of a young girl. At 18, I don't think I would let back into the home. I mean, there, you get to a point where you've just done too much. And when you falsely accuse your parents of physically and emotionally abusing you, you've gone too far. The BBC has reported in South Africa, and we heard this on the top of the hour news as well, and I want to bring this up because we have lots of listeners in the Republic of South Africa, that their top corruption fighter said that President Jacob Zuma has benefited unduly from using state money to improve his rural residents. We share this because it's not just America that is upside down morally relative to its politics and its politicians. This is true around the world. We'll consider Mr. Zuma's story after the break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Yes, corruption is widespread. Here's Jacob Zuma, and he is not just one who has benefited from public office, but he has cost taxpayers in an impoverished country, South Africa, $23 million. This is what he put into his private home, including his pool and cattle enclosure. $23 million. I mean, how do you spend $23 million on a cattle enclosure and a pool and a home in South Africa? I mean, beyond the fact of being a crook, beyond the fact of cheating the taxpayers of that poor country out of $23 million, you might also want to consider banishing him from politics for not understanding business. I mean, how do you squander that kind of money? Anyway, there's a 400-page report by the public prosecutor that details Mr. Zuma's unethical conduct. It should also be noted that Nelson Mandela's home improvements, let's call them home improvements, were similarly lavish. Former Guatemalan President Alfonso Portillo, he told a court in New York that, now why in the world is the former Guatemalan president being tried at U.S. taxpayers' cost in a New York court? I don't know. But while he was president of Guatemala, he accepted a $2.5 million bribe from Taiwan. He pleaded guilty to the count of conspiracy to launder the money. But his bribe, he said, was in exchange for a promise that his country would continue to recognize Taiwan diplomatically while he was in office. El Salvador's president, Francisco Flores, is also under investigation for the same reason. Bad boys, no matter where they are found throughout the world. Hello, Glenn. Good to have you as part of the program this morning. Which one of these stories tickles your fancy?
Oh, good morning, Ed. I have a solution for both the problem child and the problem president.
Okay, perfect.
Public caning. It works in Singapore. Spare the rod, spoil the child. Spare the rod, spoil the politician. You know, I vividly remember a story of a late teens American male who got himself arrested in Singapore for vandalizing a car or something a number of years ago, and he was subjected to a public caning. And interviewed after the event, you know, they asked him how he felt about it, and he said, "Well, you know, I'll never do that again." And, you know, was he psychologically damaged or, No, he got the lesson. He understood. It's amazing.
If with politicians, committing these kinds of crimes, also if it were, criminals, rapists, pedophiles, that sort of thing, if in addition to separating them from society and giving them a long time out in prison, there was an aspect of this where, you know, the caning wasn't to the point where it was permanently scarring, but it was like a really, really good spanking that was humiliating and painful. You know, it would cause people to have second thoughts about such behavior. You know, I was talking to Aaron during the break and said, you know, if you had a daughter and your daughter accused you of falsely, of emotionally and physically abusing her, would she be welcome back into your home? And his response was, no way.
No. She should be caned for being a useless narcissist who defames her parents. It's very simple, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, there should be a consequence of her filing that lawsuit. There should be a consequence of her egregious behavior. And when you don't set standards of what you think is acceptable with your children, then you put them in a position where it's not a surprise that this girl is a spoiled brat. If her parents simply said, "You're welcome back after doing all of these heinous things, you're welcome back," there's something wrong with them and the way they're raising her.
Right. Well, they're setting themselves up to be like, for something else to occur where she might be able to lodge some more substantive allegation later or something, you know.
Yeah. I've got one for you here. Let me share this story. It's a personal story. I'll have to do it when we get back. It's a story about my son and Spanky. I did not have an answer for him then when he responded the way he did. We still laugh about it to this day. But I'm going to share a story of spanking a 2-year-old and what the 2-year-old had to say and see if you got a response, Glenn. We'll be back after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I said I would share a story of my personal life. Our eldest son was not crazy about his brother coming into the world. He had a pretty good deal, and he liked it. I mean, our eldest son was never really a child. He just kind of always approached everything as an adult. And, you know, he had his mom and his dad just focused entirely upon his every need, and he rather liked his situation. And while he and his brother, our youngest son, get along famously now and did for most of their childhood together. For the first couple of years, our youngest son wasn't an engaged companion. Our eldest son saw him as a nuisance, as someone who was now taking attention away from mommy and daddy's doubting all over him. So on occasion he would hit his brother. And so one of these days, in front of my wife and I, we saw our eldest son strike his, it wasn't like with a fist or anything, but he hit his younger brother. I slapped our son on the bottom. and said, "You cannot hit your brother." And his response was, "Then why did you spank me?" If hitting is not appropriate, why did you just hit me on the bottom? He's 2 years old. Was not the easiest of all situations to answer. He still reminds us of that conversation regularly. Now, he happens to be today an engineer designing jet engines. But he can still come up with lines that have you scratch your head and say, Well, that was, by the way, that was the last time he ever got spanked. Was 2 years old. Was not in a position where I could reason my way through that response. You know, just because we're your parents did not fly with this young man. Speaking of not flying, Dateline is Beirut to Lebanon. This story is from the Washington Post. I'm identifying the Washington Post because of the opening line. Al-Qaeda appears to be steadily building its support networks and capability in Lebanon. Now, I'm going to share this story with you because what it reveals is that Yahweh got his prophecy right relative to the Syrian war spilling out into both Lebanon and Jordan. And so, since we considered that statement from Yahweh yesterday, I thought that I'd share this with you, which affirms that he was right. The fact is that they're not Al-Qaeda insurgents. They're not Al-Qaeda extremists, as they would want to call them, but they are instead just Sunni jihadists. So Sunni jihadism is steadily building support networks and capacity in Lebanon. Now, if you're a Sunni jihadist and you're building your network and your capacity, what do you think the capacity would be? You would be building your ability to what? If you're a Sunni jihadist organization, would it be to build schools? No. Would it be to build homes for the homeless? No. Would it be to build parks so that people might enjoy the great outdoors? No. Would it be to invest in business so that there are employment opportunities for the population? No. They're building the capacity to be suicide bombers. Anyway, this article says there are fears that are growing that this new influx of militants from the Syrian border region could bolster the terrorist group's ranks and stoke instability. It's a number of groups, and why they make it terror groups singular is a good question. The reality is that the spillover of the Shia-Sunni war, this proxy war in Syria, into Lebanon is just in complete harmony with Yahshua's 17 prophetic portrayal. The Lebanese authorities say that they are fighting back a relentless tide of jihadists whose attacks are exacerbating sectarian tensions. Why don't they just say that this is the same proxy war that's occurring in Syria? It's not sectarian tensions. It's Shia-Sunni conflicts. It is mirrors the proxy war occurring in Syria. The two main al-Qaeda affiliates in Lebanon, they say, Jabhat al-Nusra and Abdullah Azam brigades. And by the way, there are scores and scores of Islamic Sunni jihad groups in Syria. The al-Nusra front is probably the largest, has been for a couple of years now. The Abdullah Azam brigades is large, but not among the largest. There is no indication that either are affiliated with Al-Qaeda. They're simply Sunni jihadists. They have claimed a string of suicide bombings against Shia targets during the first 6 months of the year, or 6 weeks of the year. On Sunday, the fall of a rebel-held Syrian town of Yabrud, this means that in Lebanon, which is controlled primarily now by Hezbollah, which is Shia, that there are now some towns in Lebanon particularly along the border with Syria, with all this influx of Sunni jihadists coming to fight the great jihad in Syria, that are becoming Sunni dominant. And so this happens to be one of them. They call it rebel-held. They should really call it Sunni-held town. The Syrian army and the fighters of the Lebanese Shiite movement Hezbollah attacked in unison, which says that in Lebanon now, just as is the case in Syria, the government and Hezbollah fight together. Now, that's amazing that you would have a government and a renowned terrorist organization working in unison. But that's exactly what is happening in Lebanon. The rebel defeat at the hands of the Lebanese army and Hezbollah drove a stream of Syrian opposition fighters, these would be Sunnis, to seek refuge along the border with Syria, and it triggered an immediate retaliatory series of suicide bombings that killed several people, mostly in a Shiite town. The attack was claimed by the Lebanese branch of Jabhat al-Nusra, which they claim is an al-Qaeda affiliate that is smaller than its Syrian wing. It's the al-Nusra Front in Syria, but Jabhat al-Nusra and the al-Nusra Front, sometimes called the Victory Front, the supporters of Victory, all the same organization. It does not have national affiliates. Its affiliation is with Islam. So here's the Washington Post writing an article, and the journalist can't get any of his terms or designations right. Is it any wonder that people are so lost? This is amongst the top two or three newspapers in America. The article continues, with tensions high, Hezbollah tightened a blockade on roads to a Sunni town, prompting the Sunni protesters to retaliate by burning tires and cars, also blocking the highway to a Shiite-dominated area. The influx of fighters into Lebanon is one more example of the Syrian war's overflow across its borders. The Washington Post has this wrong. There is a correlation between what's happening, but when you realize that the Syrian war isn't a civil war, but is instead a proxy war, and that the same proxy war is taking place across the Middle East, that no matter what country, if the majority are Shia, the Sunni, are terrorizing the Shia. If the majority is Sunni, the Shia are terrorizing the Sunni. And it's taking place throughout the Middle East. It has no national borders. It isn't a spillover from the Syrian war. It's all part of an ongoing 1,400-year conflict between Sunni and Shia Islam. It's why Yahweh spoke of Muslims in Bereshit, in the first book of the Torah, saying that their hands will be against their brothers, and their brothers' hands will be against them, while they live in hostility with the whole world. The Abdullah Azam Brigades, the Washington Post article reads, is a Lebanese al-Qaeda affiliate. They aren't Lebanese, and they aren't an al-Qaeda affiliate. Neither statement is accurate. Slave to Allah. And they are fundamentalist Muslims. They're just a Sunni Islamic organization. They pose the most immediate threat, said a senior army officer, who, by the way, now conducts joint missions with Hezbollah, who spoke on the condition of anonymity because of the sensitivity of the subject. Now, why would it be sensitive to talk about the fact that Shia and Sunni Muslims in the countries where they interact and intermix, like Lebanon, like Syria, like Iraq, throughout the United Arab Emirates, are killing one another? I mean, it's obvious they're doing so, and by the hundreds of thousands. Why is that a sensitive subject? Why can't we just say that the two largest sects of Islam are as ruthless towards one another as Islam is towards non-Muslims? That's the truth. It's undeniable. Why is it sensitive to tell the truth? The group has asserted responsibility for double suicide bombings on the Iranian Cultural Center in Beirut and the embassy of Iran. This is now this brainchild who worked for the Washington Post said that that Iran is a country that backs Hezbollah and the Syrian government. It is a country that backs Hezbollah. Hezbollah is the militant arm of the Iranian government. Hezbollah is as much part of Iran as the U.S. Marines are to America. There's not a country that backs Hezbollah. They are Hezbollah. We'll be back in a moment. I'd like to conclude the Washington Post article because their concluding statement does affirm the truth, even though they can't figure it out. They say the officer, the officer in the military for Lebanon, who of course does joint drills and policing action with Hezbollah, said that the Azam brigades and Zabat al-Nusra appear to work in tandem and release joint statements. Now, I know this is asking a lot of someone who's been educated in the politically correct institutions of America and has earned their degree in English, but if they work together, if they issue joint statements, if their statements all credit Allah and cite the Quran, if they are following Muhammad's example, might there be something that unifies them? You think that maybe they're playing from the same constitution, and that constitution is Islam? I mean, why is it that today's journalists can't connect the dots and never seem to be able to go from knowing to understanding? Have we created an entire society? I mean, here's someone whose job it is to understand what's happening around the world and to report on it. And they can't transition from knowing to understanding. Amazing. Now, I know this is a sensitive subject, and I should be speaking on the basis of anonymity. But here's a report from the Morningstar News. Islamic extremists, they say, not Islamist fundamentalists. Again, they know what occurred, they just don't understand why it occurred. And the moment you call the boys that we're going to speak of next extremists as opposed to fundamentalists, then you have abrogated understanding. The Islamic extremists from the Rebel al-Shabaab militia last week publicly beheaded a mother of two girls and her cousin in a southeastern part of Somalia, after discovering that they may have been Christians. Yes. Now, Al-Shabaab, which means the lads, it's a fundamentalist Islamic terrorist organization doing what jihadists normally do, creating mischief. In fundamentalist Islam, according to the Quran, and that's all you have to do is read the Quran, it is not acceptable to be a Christian. Now, you can be a Christian so long as you're deprived of your wealth, so long as you have no rights, so long as you are publicly and politically and religiously humiliated, according to the Quran. Then, yes, you can continue to hold a religious belief other than Islam, but it's only under the condition that you surrender your property, you surrender your wealth, you surrender your pride, you surrender everything and are acknowledge that you're inferior. But in a country that is essentially 100% Islamic, that isn't even acceptable. And by the way, if the Christian were to speak to someone about Christianity, that would be justification for killing them. Well, these two women, their only crime is that they may have been a Christian. So they were murdered. Their heads were cut off in public. What's the message? You'll either be a Muslim or we're going to kill you. When a Muslim writes me at Prophet of Doom and says, Islam is the fastest growing religion and you're just afraid of it. You're jealous. They say, yeah, it's growing because the Islamic population growth is out of control. And to cease being a Muslim in an Islamic country is a death sentence. In the port town of Bar Arwa, the extremists, they say, these would be Islamic fundamentalists, on March 4th, called residents to the town center to witness the executions of the 41-year-old mother, Sadia Ali Omar, and her 35-year-old cousin, Osman Mohamud Moj. Before killing them, Al-Shabaab announced, "We know that these two people are Christians who recently came back from Kenya, and we want to wipe out any underground Christian living inside of the Mujahideen area." End quote.